tonight on Arena. Sean Penn and Dylan Penn on their new film Flag Day, and Peter Coonan on Dinion. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Irish language cinema is a growing artistic force in this country. Last year, we had the critically acclaimed Arrupt, and Fosca, the adaptation of Donal Ryan's novel The Thing About December, is due for release in March. And released at the end of this week is Dinion, the debut feature from director Damien McCann. It's a taut missing persons mystery set on a stunning island off the northwest coast, starring Peter Coonan and Breege Brennan. All is not as it seems when Tomás's wife Siobhan and young son Oisin go missing from their holiday home. Most recently, of course, we've seen Peter in Hidden Assets, and who could forget his iconic portrayal of the criminal Fran Cooney in Love Hate. I'm delighted to be joined by Peter Coonan on the line. Peter, this is not your first foray into Irish language drama.
No, I did Arrucht 2 years ago. It's a lot, it's 3 years since we shot it, but I didn't actually speak Irish in that. I played a British soldier. So, but I've done some TV, Ascuelga Choma, and but this is my first feature film where I speak Irish, I believe.
And is the language important to you?
It is indeed. Yeah, I grew up. I went to all Irish primary school, Scolarchon and Clóistean, Booterstown, and I am very proud of the fact that we're having a massive moment for Irish language films, somewhat of a golden age, and I think that it's only going to get stronger and stronger as the years go on. And TG Carr have been brilliant in supporting Sidney Carr, two films every year for the last couple of years, and I think the quality is just improving year after year.
Yes, it's a very exciting time, and this is so exciting because it's a thriller. So can you give us the premise? I said there that you played Tomás, but tell us about his line of work and why he's on an island with his young family.
Well, he's an investigative journalist who is also a documentary filmmaker, and he has left the mainland to come to get away because his wife isn't well after suffering from postpartum depression, and he is trying to set up a new life for himself and his family. And at the beginning of the film, he comes back and he finds that his child and wife have disappeared, and there is very little police presence on the island, so he has to put all his faith and trust in Breege Brennan's character, Leisha. And the story kind of develops the power dynamic between the two people and the kind of misconceptions that each of them have of one another. And without giving too much away, that kind of dynamic kind of really develops as the story goes on, and little bits begin to reveal themselves about each of the characters, and that where the story lies for me.
Yes, and Tomás seems to be a loving husband. He's very concerned about his wife. He obviously adores his child. But he has this hard-nosed job of an investigative reporter, which brings him into the kind of criminal world, really, because we see his own office space is interesting. Could you just bring us into that other professional space of Tomás?
Yeah, well, I suppose in some of the documentaries that he made, he's investigating criminals in Dublin. And I think as the story goes on, we see that he might have gotten in too deep with some of his investigations. And maybe I think this is the idea as well of that. This is the ego. This is what interested me about the character, that there's nothing that he can't do, and he has the answers to everything. And I think with the work he's done, he's actually seems to have put his family at jeopardy, and maybe that's, we get a sense that that's why he actually ran away to the island, to get away from people who he had maybe manipulated in a certain way to try and get stories out of them, and that they are after him, or he may have borrowed some money, or we just don't know. But there's a certain, there's something, that a darkness that lies beneath the surface that you wouldn't certainly see at the beginning, I think, from his characterization and from...
Indeed there is. And I'm sure people can guess from our conversation that there's so much we can't give away, Peter. Breech Brennan is Lisha, and she is the only, I suppose, type of police person there is on the island. That's a great relationship between you and her, because at one stage she's a very nurturing woman. She's forever bringing flasks of soup to people. But at the other, on the other hand, she's canny enough, and she can't be hoodwinked very easily.
As you go on in the story, it's difficult to give stuff away, but I think she knows more than she lets on, I suppose. I think everyone knows more than they're letting on in the story. But her, the way she plays it as well, she's kind of like a stillness, a beacon in the middle of this tumultuous storyline that's happening. And her stillness and her focus and her intelligent eyes that we are so treated to throughout the film is just a very kind of strong force of listening to everything that is going on and taking all the information in. And it's Tomás that kind of nearly underestimates her, I think.
Tomás is another in the line of very interesting characters you get. Let's say Peter in Hidden Assets. How much fun, I suppose, was it to play Peter?
To play...
Peter in Hidden Assets.
Fionn Branigan. Not at all. It was great. It was a great character to play. I mean, it was two episodes, really, you know, throughout. And for me, it was a small space. It was nearly like shooting a film, because there was two episodes and so much happens over those two episodes. And initially, when I was preparing for the role, I had to go over and shoot one day in Antwerp. So I had to isolate for 9 days to shoot one day in Antwerp. But basically, the penultimate scenes were the ones I was shooting. So it was the most heightened the character was. So for 9 days, I'm sitting in a room my own preparing for these two scenes that are the last scenes we'll see of the character. So that was quite intense, but it was also lent itself to give me time and space to be able to do that. Whereas being at home, a family, it's difficult to get that time and space to prepare for those characters. So that kind of COVID worked in my favor in that regard.
And but, a very different side of criminality than you would have portrayed in Love Hate. Criminal, nevertheless, but a different side.
Yes, a completely different side of it, and different reasons for doing it, and different backgrounds. You know, someone who has been reared with a silver spoon, I suppose, and everything that could have he possibly wanted, he got. But things got a little bit out of hand and overreached, and just similar to Tomás in the way that, you know, there was nothing that he didn't think that he deserved for a time. And then I think the conscience gets the better of him, and he has to kind of try and back out. And by the time he tries, it's too late.
Now, getting back to Dinyan, again, the drama builds and builds and builds, and there's great tensions. There's jump out of your seat moments in the thriller aspects of the film. But it builds up to this climactic scene of a storm. How challenging was it to shoot the storm on the island?
Well, it was very challenging on the budget that we had, but I think they did a wonderful job. I didn't see the bits that we see. Obviously, a lot of it is done with CGI and various stuff. But the final scenes that we shot were the last day of our shoot, and we'd had quite a difficult shoot. But obviously, during the pandemic, we had a lockdown for 2 weeks. We were all in a hotel for 2 weeks up north, and then when we got back up again, the first day we did one day and then we were hit again, but then we got back after 4 days. So for what was meant to be 3 weeks was 6 weeks in the end. But shooting the storm on the island, we just had a big rain machine one of the days, and it happened to be raining as well that day. It was quite an incredible day, because we had put so much effort into the whole shoot of it that we got a bit of luck as well with a bit of heavy rain that came in that day as well. So it was kind of a pathetic fallacy, I suppose. We got blessed by the gods.
Absolutely. And Peter, I think we should let people have a listen to a clip from Dinyan. Here, Tomás, played by yourself, reports his wife missing to the local and perhaps slightly maverick retired guard, Alicia.
Tomavan Kayla Eric. Hagus Moa.
Seanish. Glacan.
Honig mea wali agus niro si an. Tan lan of ime.
Bedjigar ag si nota dich na gwaka tu.
Ta glust an ime.
Hala mi tu ra nis luchia garo si chin. Ma ta agus lan of eki. Ni vei si a wader hir.
Ta imni arum ginyar na si rodegin si a fodjach.
Ji hien no din lan of.
Elisigam. Ano, ni enna si dochar do sin.
Anish, na bi o sgeil o'r gyffoelin, ha? Bish diach lad? Cwrdd me e'n cilch ilygol.
Peter Coonan there in a scene from Dinyan with Breach Brennan. And after this, Peter, I know you're back from being abroad. What will we look forward to seeing you in next?
Well, I have a part in the upcoming series of Peaky Blinders, which is coming on
very
BBC,
exciting,
I think,
yeah.
in March. And then a series I'm shooting at the moment, I think that's out sometime next year. I don't know, they haven't come for a name for me yet, but I'm not sure if I can speak about it at the moment. But then I'm shooting an Irish film down in Cork at the moment called The Gates with a young director called Steve Hill. So I've been kept busy, which is good. So long may it continue.
Always good. Thanks very much to Peter Coonan. And Dinyan opens in cinemas on Friday. Well, the poet Philip Larkin had famously choice words to say about the bad ways in which parents can affect their children. They may not mean to, but they do, he says. And in the film Flag Day, which opens this weekend, we will see just how detrimental that relationship can be, even when the damage is unintentional and the bond is loving. John Vogel, played by Sean Penn, was a real-life con man and one of the most notorious counterfeiters in US history. His daughter Jennifer, played by Sean Penn's own daughter, Dylan Penn, adored her father and as a child was in constant awe of his ability to make life feel like a wonderful adventure. But things fell apart, testing the very limits of that father-daughter bond. Flag Day premiered at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this year. It's based on Jennifer Vogel's 2004 memoir about her father, Flim Flam Man. The film is directed by Sean Penn himself and it includes original music written and performed by our own Glenn Hansard, Eddie Vedder and his daughter Olivia Vedder. Earlier I spoke to Sean Penn and his daughter Dylan Penn, but before we hear that, let's listen to the song My Father's Daughter, performed by Glenn Hansard, Olivia Vedder and Eddie Vedder.
They asked if I had seen you, but I've got no truck with a man like that. They can go to hell. I am my father's daughter. Come hell or high water. Never gonna leave him.
Sean and Dylan Penn, you're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Flag Day is concerned with the life of the con man and counterfeiter John Vogel and based on the book written by his daughter Jennifer, The Flim Flam Man. But the film takes as its centrepiece the relationship between the father and the daughter, the love, the distrust, the truth, the deception in their lives. Sean, John Vogel was a man born on Flag Day, the day Americans celebrate the American flag, the stars and stripes. But Vogel seems to be let down by the country he was born into. Can you introduce us to John Vogel?
Yeah, well, I will try to do that, you know, tailing off the way you introduced it. I think that many, that the America of today is grappling strongly with something that has always been, which is a kind of promise that one man or woman sees as consistently broken, a promise of the American aspiration, the American experiment, they are consistently left behind in it, and then others who find a way to thrive in it. Somewhere in between, there is a, you know, it is a country wearing a mask of hyper-exceptionalism. And so it creates sort of schisms in the personality of the people who this movie is about, and of the people who we can watch are joining up in cliques of varying degrees of mistrust and rage against the machine. And John Vogel is one of those, and who has struggled with an entitlement he was told was a birthright. An inventive guy, a shrewd guy in some ways, and a great naive and innocent in others. And just with what I've just described, what would that be to parent a child? What would be the ability to share his authentic self with those he loved, which becomes the other corruption that happens in such a society, the intimate corruption of the relationships that one has with people. So I found it so rich. Given that, both from Jennifer's true telling of the story and from Jez Butterworth's screenplay, which I thought was beautiful. I also had an immediate attachment to my daughter's face as that which represented the Jennifer I was reading. And so this was, of particular interest to me to try to make this film Flag Day.
Dylan, when it's some years in the works, Flag Day. So were you approached very early on by your dad when he first got the script from the Butterworths?
I read the book around the same time that he got the rights the first time around. And I loved the book. I loved the story, but never considered myself an actor, never wanted to be in front of the camera. So it just seemed like a ludicrous idea. Also, I was very young. I was around 15 and I don't know if I subconsciously knew this then, but looking back, I think there was definitely a part of me that felt that I didn't have enough experience to even understand the kind of life that Jennifer led and tells in Flim Flam Man. So, when he came back around almost 15 years later, I did feel like I had that kind of life experience to reference to. And I did feel certain parallels to Jennifer's life in terms of finding her own identity separate from her family, and also understanding that that your family and your relationships inherently affect who you are as a person. So I did feel like I could tell Jennifer's story in an authentic way at that point.
Sean, as you said, the writing team on Flag Day is, and it's very well known team across the Atlantic here. Jez Butterworth is, of course, the author of Jerusalem. When did you approach Jennifer then to come in? Was their script the gospel for the film, or did you make contact with Jennifer Vogel herself, and did she give input into the film for both you and Dylan?
Yeah, the screenplay was certainly the initial gospel. With any screenplay, because I can't do the math for you now, but I would say about half of the things that I've done as a director, I've written, either written originally or adapted myself. The other half I would then take and I would find they may be of the greatest quality and seemingly untouchable, but for me to enact my process as a director on something, I typically will then do a revision of my own, if only as an exercise in knowing the material. So I'll go page by page and I'll find that I want to change an image of the place that we're in, the personality of the environment sometimes, or I'll go, or in this case, I fed on Jennifer's book where I thought, you know, I see why they did not use this part from the book, but I think this part from the book maybe tells the story better than this, you know, for me, better than this. And I would do kind of an obsessive 2-week, very slow revision that kept the original script, you know, 90% intact, but that those other things were very much informed by Jennifer's book. And I used, you know, the original screenplay, for example, had no narration. So for the narration, I went into the prose, as I had done on Into the Wild. I went into the prose of Jennifer's writing, largely to find those words and thoughts and to be able to create more economy of scenes and images than had been originally there. So it becomes to some degree a blend. And Jennifer was always, when I was working on that stuff, Jennifer was always one phone call away, and she was unusually valuable to work with because she, while this is a story that means so very much to her, she also recognized that there would be licenses taken and that it would be important that I was shooting things, telling parts of the story, sometimes in ways that allowed them to be focused the way that I would understand and own them. And that we were not going to be, because I had felt licensed from the beginning, because there was quite a bit of license taken in Jez's screenplay. So that was what was, what I first read. But yes, it ultimately became, you know, very collaborative. And that extends to the actors. I'm very inviting of any smart head in the team. This goes to my assistant directors and producers and cameraman, where I got a lot of input as I was sort of doing a revision that I felt I could own and run with.
Dylan, maybe you talk us into one of the scenes. It's the first scene where you, playing the role of Jennifer, meets with her father as now a young adult or a teenager. And she's older and she wants to piece together the fact from fiction. We'll listen to a clip.
Any thoughts about college? I guess you get time.
Actually, I want to study journalism.
Journalism? What kind of journalism?
Investigative, maybe.
I like that. I can see my Snickelfritz digging on the titans of industry, the fast food chain motherfuckers. Just a bunch of crumbs bound together by dough, right?
Dad, what do you do?
What do you mean, what do I do?
I mean, for a living, what do you do for a living?
You know what I do for a living? I'm an entrepreneur. My skill is opportunities.
Like what?
For instance, right now I got a whole raft of businesses. I'm working a very broad portfolio. And when you work it that way, you're not dependent on one business to be your bread and butter. You know, yield goes down on one, pops up on another. And the good news is that I'm doing really great with that.
That's a key scene, isn't it, when they're renewing their relationship, but Jennifer is now older.
Very much so. I think I love that scene also because I think it's so ironic that she, yes, she is older and she's just left her mother's house to hopefully live with her father. And she's ready to be authentic and honest and she's asking for that in return from her father, but she still has this goth look that is really something to hide her authentic self. So I think it's funny that she's looks like something she's not. But I also think it's,
yeah, it's just, I mean, this is like the issue with their relationship is that she's so ready to be vulnerable and truthful with her father and begin an adult relationship. And I think asking for that in return is something that she expects and doesn't really get in the end.
And Sean, how would you direct a scene like that? You are deeply in the scene because there's only the two of you in it, but you have the role of the actor and you're also the director. What is your practice as a director within that scene?
Make sure there's a camera with a long lens on it, photographing every pore of Dylan's face as she expresses her truth and her hunger for mine. And that there's a complimentary camera on me to do all I can to avoid that truth she's seeking. And so, I will say with Dylan, unembarrass her on the phone, that, you know, we hear a lot, we talk a lot as actors about listening to the other actor. Well, I had two compelling reasons to do that. One was so that my own performance would be responsive to what she brought. But the other was that in this case, acting and directing, that was the time for me to see what she was doing in her performance. And I just was, it was all I could do to keep up and to deflect because I had this beautiful wall of truth and emotion coming at me. And I still had the rules of storytelling, meaning the character that I had to hold true to. And by that, I mean untrue to. And so it was like being on a witness stand in front of a great prosecutor in cross-examination and doing all I could do to survive, which meant running away from the truth she was seeking.
Just before we finish, I have to ask you about the soundtrack, which is fantastic and a very strong Irish link here with the presence of Glenn Hansard. How did you put it together?
Yeah, well, I always say that I'm a very music and narration dependent director, and I had an extraordinary experience with Eddie Vedder, and would always reach out to him first no matter what the mission was. In this case, the mission up front was very clearly that this would be primarily a female voice that was going to tell Jennifer's story or complement Jennifer's journey, and yet there is the yin and yang of it, the father-daughter story. So I thought, well, I'm not going to follow a one set rule here. There will be time for male voices, but I he's the songwriter and the voice that starts me getting excited about things. And so Ed came in and very quickly brought in Glenn. And Glenn Hansard and Ed Vedder sat in a room while I was working on the revision of the script. They went and rented a place not far from me on the beach in Los Angeles. And they kind of cornered up and just started writing songs over a 5-day period. And we'd meet up at lunchtime and I would be hearing these slices of magic. And then soon after, we were going to have to find the female voice who might sing those songs. And that itself was a process and ultimately ended with me going to Dylan because I was looking for a voice that would connect with her emotionalism. And she recommended Cat Power. The coincidence was that Cat Power had worked with Ed before. They knew each other. And then Cat Power was brought into it and brought much more than just a voice. She became the third writer. And so I had this, excess of riches with these three great singer-songwriters really working as a team for this story and submitting material that we could play with in different scenes at different times. And it just kept coming in. And we were getting songs and adjustments and songs right to the very end of the editing period. And that's what you have when you see this movie.
Yes, great songs for a great film. Sean and Dylan Penn, thank you very much. Flag Day opens on Friday. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. The Gilded Age in 1880s New York City was a period of immense social upheaval, of huge fortunes made and lost, and the construction of new palaces that spanned the length of Fifth Avenue. In a new series named The Gilded Age, writer Julian Fellowes of Downton Abbey fame has moved stateside to tell this story. At its centre, the heroine Marion Brooke, who moves to New York to live with her wealthy aunts, wealth derived from old money. Along Fifth Avenue, a new nouveau riche family, that of railroad tycoon George Russell, has built an extraordinary home. But all he and his wife meet is social rejection from the old guard. I'm joined now by Darrell Jones, who has been watching The Gilded Age for us. So this is a new series penned by Julian Fellowes, who has got so much fame and wealth himself from Downton Abbey. So is it the mores and the class system of Britain transferred to New York?
In a manner of speaking, I mean, Downton Abbey in New York is very clearly the pitch for this. And so we get all the things that Julian Fellowes, who is the presiding genius behind this, has form here in Downton Abbey, but also in Gosford Park. So he presents us with this extremely stratified, class-ridden world, but it's also an upstairs, downstairs world, a world of wealth, and a world of contrasting wealth in this case, as you said, you know, old money versus new money. So in some ways, yes, all the reasons for watching Downton Abbey, from the production values to the costumes to the social mores, transposed to New York.
Now, as I said, there's Marion Brooke, who comes to her father has become penniless,
yeah,
and so she moves to New York in with her rich aunts. Christine Baranski plays Agnes von Wren, and she explains to her that she must make her debut in society, but only with the old people. And Cynthia Nixon is also in the scene, and she plays the sister Ada Brooke.
Must attend to your clothes, my dear. You will go tomorrow with Ada to my dressmaker, and no black.
But I'm in mourning.
People here won't know when Henry died. You're making your debut in society. You are young and pretty and need to be shown to advantage. I don't want you hanging about on the edge of things like a lonely crow. Ada, remember, I want cheerful colors, whatever she says.
But we must look out for some people with sons and daughters your age.
That's true. I don't know anyone.
Now, you need to know, we only receive the old people in this house. Not the new. Never the new.
What's the difference?
The old have been in charge since before the revolution. They ruled, justly, until the new people invaded.
It's not quite as simple as that.
Yes, it is.
Well, I'm new. I've only just arrived.
Marion, never mind that the Brooks have been in Pennsylvania for a century and a half. My mother, your grandmother, was a Livingston of Livingston Manor, and they came to this city in 1674. You belong to old New York, my dear, and don't let anyone tell you different. You are my niece, and you belong to old New York.
That's a scene from The Gilded Age that Darrell Jones has been looking at for us. So that's the old wealth. So we get a good picture of where they're coming from. So paint a picture of the Russells then, who are moving into this extraordinary mansion that they have they built from scratch?
That's the impression one gets. They've employed Stanford White, who was the great Gilded Age architect of New York, to build this mega opulent mansion in the Upper East Side of New York. So we see New York being built around us as we watch. So Central Park still has livestock on it, and they've built their ultra opulent mansion for which they've plundered, you know, all the art galleries and museums and stately homes and castles of Europe for all the treasure that they can buy. Theirs is bought wealth, newly bought wealth. And they move. They build this right next door, right across the road from Van Ryn. So the two families are eyeing one another across the street.
And what is the problem with them?
Well, the problem with them is that these are new money. The George himself is
a railroad magnate.
He's an industrialist. His wife Bertha, we are told, is from poor Irish family. Her ancestors dug potatoes in Kerry. We're told this on more than one occasion. So, you know, counterpointed to the kind of patrician old money, and we heard, you know, Christine Baranski's very acidulous delivery of these barbed comments that she does throughout. That's one, at least, of the clashes that the show sets up.
So Russell's kind of the Kardashians of their age? Are they a bit tacky?
I think that's the implication we're meant to have, and certainly viewed through the eyes of Agnes across the road. Yes, they live in this massive palace of bling, I suppose is what it is. You know, they've bought, they have this expensive French chef that they've brought in. It's all gorgeous, and you know, one of the main plots that recurs throughout the five episodes that I've seen is Bertha Russell's attempts, which are varyingly successful, to sort of ingratiate herself into and enter a Manhattan high society.
Yeah, and even if her family used to dig praties back in Ireland, she is bullish in her wish to break through.
Oh yes, I think so. And this is one of the things that struck me while watching it. Is I thought the show, though it affects a kind of even-handedness, and though Christine Baranski gets lots of great lines, the heart of the show seems very much on their side. We are with them, and I think because both the Gilded Age and the Russell family are a sort of affecting a classiness they don't really have. The show really wants to be Henry James, but it's actually Downton Abbey, and that's not a bad thing. But you know, it has this all these extraordinary production values, this beautiful furniture, this wonderful kitchen full of copper. You know, so there are lots of good reasons for watching it.
Okay, let's listen to the people across the other side of the street. Here, Bertha Russell, played by Carrie Coon, receives a letter inviting her to support a charity for orphan girls. She believes this is the beginning of her acceptance into high society in New York.
A Mrs. Morris and a Mrs. Fane want me to support a charity in aid of orphan girls.
Is that Mrs. Patrick Morris and Mrs. Charles Fane?
Yes, it is. Why?
Their husbands are city aldermen. I may have some business with them. What do the wives want of you?
Well, to start with, there's a meeting for Friends of the Cause to be held at the Fifth Avenue Hotel.
Really? Not in one of their own houses?
I dare say a hotel was more convenient.
I hear the Fifth Avenue's slipping. No one wants to be down on 23rd Street anymore.
I won't let you spoil it for me.
I don't want to spoil it.
It's beginning. I knew it would. Persistence is the key to everything. Patience and persistence.
Useful qualities, I agree.
Could I come, Mother? Please?
Take her. Why not?
I'll think about it.
When is it?
On the 1st.
I'm seeing John Thorburn that day.
Who's he?
A man who owns a railroad and thinks he can get the better of me.
He'll find out.
Carrie Coon there as Bertha Russell and Morgan Spector as her husband, George. Now, there's also an upstairs, downstairs. We're in the houses. So is it in the Russell house we get most of that, or in the Van Ryn house?
A bit of both, actually. In the there's the usual cast, I think. The Russells have a kind of kindly, wise patrician, slightly snobbish butler who seems classier than everybody else in the thing. But the, you know, there are gambling addicts. There's burgeoning romances. You know, there's an ambitious and sexy maid servant. There's a mysterious man servant who disappears and we don't know where he goes. While the focus, at least in the earlier episodes, is on the life upstairs, you get the downstairs worlds unfold themselves.
So we know from the work of Edith Wharton, which I think you've referenced, and Henry James, you know, how stultifying and encasing this society can be. Do you get that sense from this series?
Very much so. So Marion, who is a young and, you know, kind of sort of quasi-feminist figure who chafes at this repression, brings with her a friend she meets on the journey there, a young African-American woman, Peggy Scott, who finds a place in the Van Ryns household. And between them, the pair of them encounter and experience various narratives of both sexual enclosure and stricture and racial tensions as well. But absolutely the kind of sexual decorum and propriety imposed upon the female characters is very startling.
So it may be Downton Abbey moves to New York, but is there enough in it, drama-wise?
Well, after the first episode, I thought to myself, I'm not enjoying this, you know? And I kept with it. And while I wouldn't say I was hooked by the end, I would certainly watch more, and I certainly enjoyed it.
Yes, I think there's a lot of the same thing happening over and over again, but That's interesting enough. My thanks to Daryl Jones. The Gilded Age begins on Sky Atlantic and Now TV tomorrow. Just past 10 to 8. I'm now joined by Montreal-born writer Sarah Freeman. Sarah's debut novel, Tides, follows a 37-year-old woman, Mara, who walks out on her life after a terrible loss. With no direction to go in but the sea, she ends up in a seaside town, knowing no one, with her money running out. Tides is a spare, emotional novel where blank space vies with words for most page space. I'm delighted to be talking to Sarah Freeman. Sarah, as I say, emotion and form are key to your novel Tides. I believe the novel's focus changed as you worked on it.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I started the novel in many ways as a regular, conventional, long-form novel, and found on second draft that, in fact, the parts that were most alive needed to take up more space on the page. And so I really pulled back on what felt like excess and made these little shards of language the sort of central territory of the novel.
Yes, because as you read the book, maybe you'll describe it in one page, we might have one long paragraph and then a very short paragraph, or maybe two short paragraphs. But they're all moving the narrative on or exploring an emotional aspect to the central character's life or existence.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes those short passages were really just fragments of language that Mara, the protagonist, remembers, recalls, and can't sort of rid herself of. And so they serve as a reminder of the old life.
Yes, because then, of course, the novel is called Tides. So presumably, I was wondering whether even the shape of the pages in some way reflect the kind of fullness of a tide or the ebbing of a tide.
Oh, I like that reading very much. I do think I thought a lot of the push and pull of the language, of the rhythms, and also of the way the text looked on the page. And so that was very much sort of, if not consciously in my mind, then in the subconsciously going on as I was writing.
And now Mara is deeply troubled and traumatized, and she's leaving some terrible experiences behind that we don't really get to know only after some time when she's trying to make her way in this new town. But if you look at it objectively, Mara's doing what a lot of people dream of doing, is like closing the door and walking away from their lives and leaving not a trace.
I certainly, put a little bit of my own fantasy about that kind of leaving behind and not having to have one's family, one's roles with oneself. But it's true that she is not just someone trying to leave behind her life for kicks, but because something quite terrible has happened to her.
Yes, but I thought it was interesting. You'd obviously worked it out very well. She can't use her credit cards. She doesn't have a phone. So therefore, do you think it is possible to get lost in this day and age?
I think there's an element of fantasy in the novel, I think it would be very, very difficult to be completely lost. I think we're so tethered to our phones, to our email, to our location, that I think it would be quite challenging. And so there is, I think, an element here of suspension of disbelief, certainly.
So, we see her doing everything she can to try and, you know, live in this seaside town. She gets a job. She kind of stows herself away in the attic of the premises she gets the job in. All these kind of hints or tips as to how you could survive with no money or source of money. But she can't hide really the terrible loss she feels. How did you go about allowing that to bubble up into her narrative as she describes it to us in Tides?
Well, it was, it was an act of a lot of trial and error. There were many drafts where some of her backstory might emerge a little bit earlier, and I felt it was too soon. Even sort of the admission of her name happens quite late in the narrative. And so all of these were very carefully parsed timings and trying to find a way not to hold back on the reader, but also not to give everything away at the very beginning. So it was, a balancing act, certainly.
One thing that we do hear about early on in the novel is that she had a very close relationship with her brother I think she's maybe 2 years older than him, is she? So from him being in the nursery, she is bonded to him. And what interested you in exploring that kind of sibling relationship and relationships that can maybe be, can they? Is that what you're asking? Can they be too close?
I think I was very much interested in asking that question. And in fact, it was the germ of this novel was these siblings who are too close as adults and whose childhood relationship sort of leeches into their adult life to an extent that they actually struggle to become adults and separate from one another. It ended up in this sort of subtext of the story, but it was central to my concern about this particular character and her psychology.
Yes, because we get hints that they live very near each other and that there's almost a telepathy between them.
Yes, they are nearly, they are overly identified with one another. And I think maybe particularly Mara with Paul. And so the rupture, the leaving is really also a major rupture with him.
How much does the book and let's say her arrival in the town, she getting to know people, good and bad, and then she more or less settling into the town. And then her own emotional ebb and flow. How does that mirror the stages of grief? Because she has had a loss that she's trying to come to terms with.
I do think, at the beginning, she's quite frozen. Even her language is sort of limited, her ability to speak and to interact. And there's a kind of thawing, which happens in some way in the reverse order of the seasons. She sort of thaws as it gets colder. But I did want to sort of mirror some kind of grieving process in which, her emotions come to the surface slowly.
There's been a lot of buzz around this book, Tides, and you yourself have had work published in literary magazines, shorter works up to this. What is it like? You know, you come from the academia, the academic world where you did your MFA. What kind of pressure does that put on a first novelist?
Well, I'm lucky because I finished my MFA quite a long time ago, I think nearly 10 years ago, and I failed first and tried to write another novel. It didn't quite work out. And so the pressure was very internal to write this book, and it felt like a very private process. And so I felt very shielded in some way from outside pressure because this was something that I wanted so much, and that I wasn't sure I could manage. So I'm so thrilled that the book is finding readers and really quite surprised. So it's a great treat.
Indeed. Well, I've been talking to Sarah Freeman, whose novel Tides is out now on Granta. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Leah Murphy. Mark McGraw was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan.